Today I talk with Tally Goff about her new magisterial book, Dark Laboratory, on Columbus, the Caribbean, and the origins of the climate crisis. Spanning many fields and disciplines in the natural sciences, social sciences, the humanities, and the arts, Professor Goff weaves together an historically rich and geographically complex picture of how capitalism and racism undergird the climate crisis in ways made invisible or benign via the work of the West's Dark Laboratory. Writing back through accounts of indigenous bird watching and black provisional grounds, we talk about things as seemingly different as the massive guano industry built on Chinese and Indian labor in the 19th century to Malcolm X's boyhood vegetable garden in Michigan. We talk in particular about one of the key passages of Dark Laboratory, where Tally Goff writes, quote, "Still, we managed to create a poetics out of that which wishes to destroy us and the planet. How else will we be able to live in the after? We must reassess what a problem is. Living is not a problem, as Audre Lorde reminds us. I would add that dying is not a problem either. Decomposing is essential to the natural order and cycle of life. Living at the expense of others is a problem." We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. So I want to begin by thanking you and also warning our listeners that there is no way to do justice to this remarkable book, which is so full of wonderful moments, contains so many important insights. So you all really have to get the book and read it carefully and at your own pace, and then probably read it again. We'll do what we can, and then invite you back to talk more about this as things develop, and also your second book. I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us about the title of the book, which has at least a double meaning, as well as, of course, referencing your lab. And I want to talk about your lab at the end of the podcast. But first, can you tell us a little bit about the different meanings of the title of the book and perhaps something about its genesis?
Sure. It's really just a pleasure to be on this podcast, David. I've been listening for a long time and have also read your work on these topics of what it means to speak out of place. And I'm obviously thinking about the lineage of Edward Said and different public intellectuals who felt a duty, the fascist politics of the past, the present, the future. And that's what I hope Dark Laboratory, my new book, does. The subtitle is On Columbus, the Caribbean, and the Origins of the Climate Crisis. So this book is really rooted in pedagogy, having been part of a working group on globalization and culture when I was a PhD student at Yale under the tutelage of Michael Denning, who of course studied with his partner Hazel Carby under Stuart Hall. So for me, the laboratory of Dark Laboratory is about labor and the fact that we often forget labor and labor politics within the laboratory, especially scientific laboratories. But it's really about collaboration. It's about the dark. It's about who's afraid of the dark and the multiple meanings conjured by the omission of race or Blackness or Africanness. But really, it's about literary criticism and reading, having been a student of Toni Morrison's. So it really is a reference to her 1992 book of literary criticism, Playing in the Dark. So that book, as I'm sure you will know, is about the kind of haunted nature of the United States and the literary imagination that has nothing to do with the reality of Black people, but rather a kind of white imagination of Africanness. And when I was her student, I wrote a paper about America as a haunted house and just that haunted architecture of what has been stolen, certainly from indigenous peoples, but also from Black people and on. So the book really was a chance for me to sit with these concept of the dark, but also of the work that we can do together to prevail in these trying times as we find ourselves now in 2025 with this new administration.
And one of the things that you bring out so wonderfully in the book is that the way that one is raised in the Western tradition is that the laboratory is bright and it's neutral and it shines a light on the darkness precisely. And what you show is that what it does actually is very selectively present the world in such a way as the actual dark violence that creates the lab in the first place has disappeared. And those who bring attention to it are castigated as being political or being somehow objective in bringing out things that are actually the objective truth. If we can purge it from this kind of haunted usage these days, but to actually use it in its original sense. And exactly. The way you put things together in the book, again, I referenced it in the intro, is so beautiful. You really challenge conventional notions of wholeness or completeness, and also of individuation and self-sufficiency. All these things, again, have been normalized in our everyday approach to knowledge and life. That the people should be self-sufficient, that we are hardy individuals, that there's a world out there that is complete in exactly the ways that you've exposed as being incomplete. And this messaging in your book comes out in so many ways, including the organization of the book, which is amazing. It's so poetic, and it complements your key arguments. And I wanted to ask you this, and this might be a long question or a long response to a short question. Actually, it's multi-part. I was really blown away, especially in the transition between chapters 5 and chapter 6 on guano and on bird watching. And the guano chapter is, oh, P.S., did you ever work with Eduardo Cadava at Princeton?
I knew him, and he was very inspiring, the work that he did to draw these connections. So I was very glad to be mentored by him. And actually, when I became an English major at Princeton, he was the undergraduate director of studies who convinced me to switch and helped me figure out the requirements. Yeah, there's so much kindred in terms of the Philippines and Panama and these literary worlds of guano. I haven't seen him in a long time, but yeah, he's really wonderful.
No, the reason I ask is that he was here as a visitor many years ago, maybe in the 90s. And he reached out to me and he said, I'm coming to Stanford, which is a haunted place for me. And so I asked Judith Butler who I could hang out with at Stanford. And she mentioned me, you, mm-hmm. Dave. And so we hung out and he gave this amazing paper on guano. So I was thinking there must be some connection there. So chapter 5.
He has a chapter about it in a text on Emerson that was really critical for me.
Exactly. Yeah. So chapter 5, guano, is riveting. And then you transition to chapter 6, which begins with the Central Park bird watchers case, if you will. So here's my short question, will lead to a longer answer. Tell us about guano, which is such an important chapter. And then how did you decide to transition to the bird watching, which it took me, again, as I said, some time to catch on to what you were doing. But when I did, it was mind-blowing. So could you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, thank you for the question, because it tracks the trajectory of the book and how it started as an article, an academic article or a series of articles, maybe from 2013, when I first started writing about the world of James Bond and a guano novel by Ian Fleming from 1958 called Dr. No. So you spoke about wholeness and purity, which conjures the question of eugenics. And we have this supervillain, Dr. No, who's born to a good Chinese girl and a German missionary, it might be, on the wrong side of the blanket. But he, yeah, is of mixed heritage. And this led me to look at these Orientalists kinds of questions related to guano as a kind of currency, because he ends up commandeering or occupying a guano island off the coast of Jamaica in this novel. So I went to Jamaica in search of guano and in search of Ian Fleming, who was a bird watcher. So the question not only of the guano, which is this precious fertilizer, but also the question of the birds that produce the guano became one of fascination and led me to even take up bird watching myself.
Yeah.
And as a Black woman, I thought about the politics of watching and being watched and double consciousness. The way that I got this book deal was with that chapter, the guano chapter. So the book really builds out from the heart of the book, chapter 5, as the basis for the book proposal. And it stems from a 2019 article of mine in Amerasia Journal, which had always been on my wish list of where I wanted to be published because of its history in California and UCLA and the Asian American Studies movement. When Gordon Chang and others had this call for a special issue on labor and capital, I just knew that this chapter on guano, on George Jackson, on Blackness, indigeneity, and Asianness needed to be told in terms of the case study of the Chinese in Peru. So it's been quite a long journey of many years now that I talk about it. But as far as the matter of ecology, I found that it was notable that the Chinese men who were the laborers, over 100,000 of them, were often blamed in the different historical texts from the 19th century for the extinction of the birds on these guano islands. And yeah, it just felt so orientalist and so much of the yellow peril rhetoric that I really had to wonder, what about the European invasion? What about the white overseers? What about these conditions that all these different forms of life were being forced into? And yeah, I felt I needed to tell this story from the perspective of the laborers, but also from the birds. It really came together through this lens of Black geological witness is the second part of the book. And I'm glad that it made sense to you because there's a lot in here that draws on anecdotes. And I joke that it's everything everywhere all at once. And I think it needs to be that way, organized in that fashion, because it is nonlinear and really questioning the politics of colonial time.
There are amazing photographs in this book that put the world together in a way that is so vivid and moving in many ways. You have these photographs of these laborers on mountains of guano, right? This is like the gold coin at the time, regarded almost like cocaine. It was that kind of powdery, vital substance to the economy. And I flashed immediately on miners in the Congo, cobalt miners. It's the same kind of mountainous resource in which they are, as you point out in your book, literally worked to death in order to extract this and to keep the extraction going and going to feed the world economy in that way. And then when you transition from that, it was an incredibly intense chapter 5, Ian Fleming notwithstanding, who is a weird guy. And then you go into that horrible incident in Central Park where a white woman is watching a Black man. She has a dog. He's watching birds. And she makes this horrible 911 phone call saying, I'm in Central Park. I'm with my dog. I'm being threatened. And she just pulled out the whole narrative, the expected narrative of what will likely get him killed. She knows it is legal, or maybe not consciously, but she's counting on something like that happening. And at first, I couldn't make sense of what was going on except for the bird. And then I realized it really is part of the whole architecture of your book, Tao, in terms of this pernicious mode of classifying things, of setting up classifications that make one the unobserved, right? You just are the neutral, well, almost godlike thing looking upon the world and making the pieces work together so that your unassailable position is never threatened. But you go into some detail about how all these activities work to dehumanize everybody. The whole landscape becomes leached of its humanity because of these parsings out. And you have a great discussion, too, about the naming of both birds and plants. Could you talk about
this as a kind of colonial act of domination that then becomes romanticized in the names of the bird and then feeds into, again, these epistemologies, these dark laboratories. Can you talk about naming a little bit?
Yes, definitely. And I find the prime culprit, one of them, to be Linnaeus. That wasn't his name, but it is one he adopts in the Latin form to standardize. And I think we always have to be suspicious of this standardization and what gets erased and what gets lost. And it occurred to me that there is this colonial taxonomy in the nomenclature of imperialism. And therefore, why not look at birdwatching as this very colonial habit or pastime? I'm originally from the UK, which is like a nation of bird watchers and hobbyists. So I was just thinking about the way that bird watchers are so obsessive about ticking off lists of birds that they've seen, and they'll say, oh, and it has a little yellow marking at the throat, and this specimen of the breed looks this way. And it reminded me of how people speak about people of mixed heritage. So I wanted a way to think about the violence of naming and the violence of taxidermy, the kind of colonial impulse to, yeah, place specimens in formaldehyde to be talked about as though you are an other on display in a museum, to say that you have a love for birds and then to stuff them,
yes,
to have trophies on the wall of hunting expeditions like Theodore Roosevelt obviously did, really calls into question the love of nature and what it means to be a naturalist, at least in the Western tradition. So I really wanted that chapter to be one that proposed other forms of naming, other forms of bird watching. Mm-hmm. And therefore, what does bird watching look like, let's say, in India? What are the different traditions and scientific methods that have been discredited by this, yep, Western notion of science? This Western notion that there is one scientific method, we're taught in elementary school that it works this way. For me, when it comes to the climate crisis, it's clear that the science that got us into this question, the science, yep, of mining, the science of geological extraction, will not be the science to get us out of the crisis. And I find a kind of radical optimism in the fact that there are thousands of traditions that we could be drawing on. There are thousands of other names for birds, for instance. There are thousands of ways that we could be approaching the climate crisis. So I was really inspired by Christian Cooper, the African-American man who spoke back, yeah, by recording, by turning the camera towards Miss Cooper and didn't allow her to control the narrative on her 911 call. So Central Park really is a kind of haunted space that was really appropriate for this encounter. And yeah, it made me think about what it means to be watched and to look back and to even not let the coincidence of their last names both being Cooper be a coincidence. As someone with an English last name, Goth, it prompted me to think about the invisible branches of American family trees. And that, again, I'm here in New Haven looking out at this grand New England campus, and I can see Goth Street from here, which is the bad part of town because Black people live there. But it's also named after a figure who was part of the regicide. And there's so many colonial plantation connections in terms of ownership and pedigree. So I wanted in that chapter to sit with the question of naming and to think about no in parentheses, and actually to sit with the Hemingses and the Jeffersons and who is rendered invisible, but also how we can find reparation in claiming these hobbies for ourselves, but perhaps not with binoculars bird watching. Like, exactly. How are Black bird watchers, Asian bird watchers of color, tapping into other forms of admiring nature and birds without it being an extractive process of taxonomy? I just had to listen to the bird song and listen to the bird watchers of color that I've met across different islands and learn from them.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the time we had Sarah Ahmed on the podcast, and she was talking about her book, The Feminist Killjoy Handbook. And I was thinking of a reaction to your critique, Tao, as being, you're such a killjoy. It's such a beautiful sport. And what are you doing laying on all this heavy DEI stuff on us? And we're just, it's so innocent. But then I'm reminded of this discussion you have of Ottoman and what a horrible person he was and how the Ottoman society is still clinging onto the name when all these other bird watching societies are created a distance. So it becomes precisely part of the dark laboratory. It becomes part of the way you're parsing the world and you've organized it and you've developed this life habit around it, that you will cling to its innocence, not because you love Audubon, but because, again, you want to protect your worldview. And what you do so wonderfully in the book is to show how other peoples have done exactly the same thing, but without this whole apparatus and history behind it that you're legitimizing by cloaking it in innocence, even way beyond its time, after it's been exposed to the world for what it actually is. You talk about race, capitalism, and labor, again, in extremely large-scale manners, but also in very microscopic and intimate ways. And I loved your discussion of provision grounds and these amazing gardens, and the sort of intimate personal story you tell is through, of all people, Malcolm X. Could you talk a little bit about provision grounds and the gardens and then Malcolm's garden, which is incredibly beautiful?
Sure. I really enjoyed the chance to think about the land. And obviously, Sylvia Winter's work is so powerful. She has an esteemed history at your institution, Stanford, which is complicated in interesting ways, considering that the place of her birth is Cuba. And there's such deep ties between Cuba and Jamaica, her being a Jamaican philosopher. So I really thought about the land and inheritance, and also the kind of diaspora wars that take place, at least within Black studies and the Black diaspora. So a figure like Malcolm X has always been fascinating to me, not least of all because of his mother having been born in Grenada. Yeah. So I had the chance to visit the Spice Isle and discovered, yeah, that people are eating curry there. There's a vibrant Afro-Indian community there, which relates to my second book, which is on Afro-Asian labor and foodways. So I began to think about nutmeg, which is depicted on the flag of Grenada. And though, as far as I'm aware, Malcolm X never traveled to Grenada, I thought it was interesting that in his autobiography, nutmeg shows up as this kind of currency in prison. So it led me to think, what if I was to read his autobiography through food? And furthermore, on the topic of birding, what if I was to think about the mention of not only food, but birds, and chicken shows up quite a number of times. So I wanted to pinpoint those moments in order to conjure what it means for the chickens to come home to roost.
Yeah.
And that kind of metaphor that has been used by a number of people, but is taken to be very radical when it's, I think, a very simple point. And he spoke about being a farm boy himself, the chickens coming home to roost not being a negative thing. So I feel like there's resonance here with Fanon's writing. We've been talking about Malcolm Ferdinand's work coming out of Martinique. And I wanted to just draw a kind of intellectual circuitry to re-enter Malcolm X into the provision grounds of Grenada, mm-hmm. as much as Nebraska, as much as the U.S. South, where his lineage comes from, to really just sit with the soil, to sit with the earth that he inherited, and to think about the earth and the soil beyond the plantation, and actually as a place of cultivating, as a place where time could be stolen back. I have an essay in South Atlantic Quarterly called Stolen Life, Stolen Time, And I'm just obsessed with ways that Black folks were able to steal time away and back when they were able to work on provision grounds that were peripheral to the plantation to plant their own herbs and gardens. So I think there's a lot of radical ideas that can be born in those spaces metaphorically, but also a lot of healing that comes out of cultivating African fruits and vegetables that somehow made their way across the Atlantic, and also Asian ecologies. So that chapter leads into a look at marijuana and healing, having come originally from India.
Yeah. I think I'm remembering correctly when you quote a moment in Malcolm's book where he's just lying on his back looking at the sky. It's that way of reclaiming time and really reclaiming nature. And I think what he's growing is peas. This is one of his things. And he just loves the sweetness. And he talks about looking at the sprouts and then feeling the earth. And I was contrasting that with some sort of, I think it was Kew Gardens that had the sort of whitewashing kind of enterprise. Could you talk a little bit about that in terms of, again, these ways of always burying or erasing actual violence and then trying to come up with these public relations ways of maintaining the institutions and the practices nonetheless?
Sure. I'm about to embark on the British leg of this book tour. And when you asked that question, it reminds me of how I really didn't feel welcome at the Kew Gardens archives. I don't think I talked about it that much in the book, but it was just clear that the archivist was like, oh, she's looking for all the Jamaica stuff or the Black stuff. And we're often not welcome in these archival spaces with all the policing that takes place. Mm. And on top of that, to add insult to injury, they ask for donations while you're at the gardens. And I'm thinking to further donate to the Queen's gardens and this colonial project when you consider all that has been taken. So it's just, it's curious how with the murder of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, the UK did respond and Kew Gardens did respond by saying, we need to look at the blood at the root of these plants that have been cultivated and really stolen. But there's been a lot of backtracking since 2020. Yep. And I've been taking notes on all of it. So it's great to be able to turn back to someone like Malcolm X and his texts in order to question why it is that Kew should have this sense of superiority when a garden like his in Nebraska or in the South has so much more meaning when we think about regenerative agriculture and not an agriculture that steals from the soil in terms of this monocrop logic. So there's plenty that these institutions like Kew could do to repair the soil and to pay reparations. So the book is really a challenge to those botanical gardens as being anything but neutral, and to really take to task the language of their signage and what they say that they're doing for the climate crisis and these green initiatives, when oftentimes they are just asking for more money from visitors to continue this colonial mission that they have. I welcome the chance to speak in these places and to have a dialogue about what they can actually do as someone who's descended from laborers who were forced to cultivate these different plants and ecologies that were stolen.
When you were speaking, I was thinking of, and you'd mentioned Sylvia Winters, and she has this remarkable essay that I'm sure I'll just tell the listeners about. It's called No Humans Involved. And she writes this essay. I came to Stanford in 1990, and so shortly afterwards, there was the Rodney King beating, and there was this groundswell of white liberal outrage, and not to put it down too much, but you know, hundreds of Stanford professors took out a full-page ad in the New York Times denouncing the Rodney King verdict. And Sylvia Winter writes this great essay that's No Human Involves, something, subtitle, A Letter to My Colleagues. And essentially, she says, I'm paraphrasing wildly, you all are part of the whole production of an epistemology that led to Rodney King, right? So this sort of hand washing really won't do. And this is the essay where she talks a lot about the inner eyes. at the university, what we're doing is creating these inner eyes in people that refuse inspection at all. They become naturalized and allow the violence to carry on. So good luck with the Kew Gardens, and we'll see. That could be a whole other short story, maybe in the New Yorker, who knows. I wanted to maybe end with this because I do want to talk about your lab. Mm-hmm. And you had this great quote, which I think we'll let you talk about it, but also round out our discussion of the book. And it's a beautifully written passage. You say, "Still, we manage to create a poetics out of that which wishes to destroy us and the planet. How else will we be able to live in the after? We must reassess what a problem is. Living is not a problem, as Audre Lorde reminds us. I would add that dying is not a problem either. Decomposing is essential to the natural order and cycle of life. Living at the expense of others is a problem." And when I got to that, just encapsulizes so much. But since you speak in that same passage about poetics, talk about how your poetics in the dark lab, and talk about, I'd love to hear more about your textile art and your sonic art, participates in this poetics, which is derived from the other dark laboratory, but refigures it into something that sends the message that living at the expense of others means that we are going to be destroyed in that same project, right?
And there's so much to unpack in this question, and I hope we continue to answer it for many years of camaraderie together, David. Yeah. So thank you for that prompt and for quoting from the book, because I begin the epigraph from a song from 1992 by Rage Against the Machine. And it says, "Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses." The song is Killing in the Name. And it actually refers to Rodney King. To know that Sylvia Winter was writing in a particular moment and that you were her specific colleague at the time feels resonant with the politics of today and really with confronting Klansmen and Klanswomen. So I think that there are actually those who do wish to destroy us, and we can't lose sight of that and of the politics of life and death. But I really do believe in a sense of poetics, obviously drawing on incredible thinkers like the Martinican writer Edouard Glissant and his sense of the word, but also the poesis, like the actual making, what it means to create. And that is what really excites me as a lab director, in the sense that I always think I want to make possibility possible. Mm. And I begin there. So with poesis in that sense, and then with poetics in the sense of power and politics and trying to empower those who are already doing this vital work when it comes to this struggle against climate degradation. I just don't think that we can separate out these questions of racial justice, environmental justice, and on. And it always baffles me that there are people who think that we can approach the question separately. I guess this book is just a love letter to a sense of an epistemology that I've inherited from people like Lorde, who you mentioned just now, and her poem Litany for Survival. Mm-hmm. So this idea that there are those of us who were not meant to survive. And for me, it's this kind of picture that I imagine of this laboratory, maybe in the Frankenstein sense, but it's an island laboratory. It could be a place like Hawaii or Jamaica. And we, the descendants, are the test subjects who were not supposed to survive this brutal experiment. And yet, here we are. And here we are not only surviving, but making an art form out of that survival. So that is also part of the poetics that I think someone like Sylvia Winter understands deeply and radically, in a way that life shouldn't be a problem and also death should not be a problem. Mm. So again, turning to her writing, especially her essay on the novel plot and plantation, I'm really drawn to how she talks about replantation and just the poetics of burial. So it took me city girl being alone in the rainforest, having to confront these fears of creepy crawly bugs and such, but to really learn a respect for termites of all creatures, and therein really understanding their role in terms of decomposition in the rainforest. Because I think in modern life, we would usually think, oh, a termite infestation, this is such a problem. But it's only a problem because of the violent architecture of our lives. Mm-hmm. And that we fail to recognize that this is their home or it's our shared home. So I learned a lot from the choreography of termites from ants. And I think that there is a poetics in that. And it's these kinds of small moments that we try to pay attention to in the lab. So I just feel lucky that I had the chance to write a book where I could really just luxuriate in what it means to listen to nature, to witness these formations, and to celebrate with joy the sense of survival, and also to think about who is the protagonist of the climate crisis, who is the we. Coming back to winter and this kind of politics of the grammar of the you and the us and the we, who is it that is supposed to survive or not survive? And if no humans are involved in that survival, to quote the piece that you mentioned, is that a problem? I think we have to continue asking these questions, and they're unanswered questions. For me, as a professor, the pedagogy always has to begin with unanswered questions. I remind my grad students, don't write me a paper about a question you know the answer to. I don't want this performance of what you already know. If you know it, cool. Okay. So what is something that you actually need to know the answer to? What is that vexing question? And this book comes out of 7 years of these vexing questions, a vexing question about guano. And I feel like I've tried to give an offering that answers that question about labor and capital through the story of guano.
Right. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's an incredible book. I urge everybody to get it, read it, keep it by your bedside, because you will find as you go through life, all sorts of things plug into it in a wonderful way. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.